The Fairy Queen invites us into a world where knights embark on quests that mirror our own moral struggles. Edmund Spenser's masterpiece, though unfinished, stands as one of literature's most ambitious creations, a sprawling allegorical landscape where virtues and vices take physical form. Originally planned as 12 books, each focusing on a different virtue, Spenser completed 6 plus fragments of a 7th before his death. The poem unfolds at the court of Gloriana, the fairy queen herself, a thinly veiled representation of Queen Elizabeth I. Each year, she holds a 12-day feast where adventures arise, each undertaken by a different knight. What makes this epic so captivating isn't just its adventure, but its layered meanings, simultaneously functioning as thrilling narrative, moral instruction, religious allegory, and political commentary. Imagine walking through a world where the landscape itself becomes a character, where gardens, houses, and caves physically manifest moral concepts. This is Spenser's genius, creating a universe where the abstract becomes tangible, where virtues aren't just concepts, but living challenges that must be faced with sword and shield. Have you ever started a journey confident in your abilities, only to discover how unprepared you truly were? This is the essence of Book 1, where the Red Cross Knight, representing holiness, sets forth to slay a dragon terrorizing Una's kingdom. Accompanied by Una, truth, and wearing armor bearing a red cross, he seems the perfect hero. In the Wandering Wood, he defeats Error, a half-serpent monster who vomits books and papers. Later, Archimago, a sorcerer, uses illusions to separate him from Una by making him believe she's been unfaithful. This separation proves disastrous. Red Cross meets Duessa, a witch representing falsehood, who, disguised as beautiful Fidessa, leads him to the House of Pride. Captured by the giant Orgoglio, Pride, he's rescued by Prince Arthur. His lowest point comes when despair nearly convinces him to commit suicide through twisted theological arguments. Saved by Una, he undergoes spiritual rehabilitation at the House of Holiness before defeating the dragon in a 3-day battle paralleling Christ's death and resurrection. Book 2 explores moderation through Sir Gawain, Knight of Temperance, who journeys with a palmer, representing reason, to confront various forms of excess. His quest begins when he discovers a dying woman who committed suicide after her husband was seduced by the enchantress Acracia. Taking the couple's orphaned infant, Gawain vows to defeat Acracia and destroy her bower of bliss. Throughout his journey, he faces challenges to temperance, braggadocio, empty boasting, 3 sisters representing deficiency, excess, and the golden mean, and the rage of brothers Pyrocles and Simocles. He resists temptations of wealth in Mammon's cave for 3 days without sustenance. After being rescued by Prince Arthur, Gawain completes his quest by destroying Acracia's Bower of Bliss, a place of artificial beauty and sensual indulgence. Book 3 introduces Britomart, a female knight representing chastity. After seeing her future husband Artegall in a magic mirror, she disguises herself as a knight to find him, a quest combining personal romance and dynastic destiny, as their union will produce the Tudor lineage leading to Queen Elizabeth. Britomart proves female strength can equal or surpass men's. She defeats Sir Gawain in jousting, rescues Amoret from the enchanter Bucerin, and navigates complex situations with wisdom. Unlike knights who succumb to lust, Britomart maintains integrity while pursuing legitimate love. Spenser contrasts her with lustful Malacasta, unfaithful Helenor, and perpetually fleeing Florimel. Book 4 explores human bonds through various relationships, between friends, lovers, and political allies, showing how concord binds individuals and societies. It weaves multiple storylines rather than following a single knight, introducing characters like Campbell and Triamond, whose rivalry transforms into brotherhood through Cambina's intervention. During the tournament for Florimel's girdle, which only the truly chaste can wear, a false Florimel's inability to wear it reveals how superficial judgments create discord. The book culminates in the Thames and Medway River's wedding, a cosmic celebration representing harmonious union that sustains both natural and social order. What happens when justice meets mercy? Book V explores this through Artegal, Knight of Justice, who travels with Talus, an Iron Man, representing impartial law enforcement. They confront various injustices, addressing political issues like the Netherlands' rebellion against Spain and English intervention in Ireland. Spencer examines the tension between justice's severity and mercy's compassion. When Artegal defeats Radagund, an Amazon queen who humiliates captured knights, he hesitates to kill her upon seeing her beauty, a mercy that backfires when she captures and humiliates him. The book's philosophical center emerges when Artegal debates a giant proposing to eliminate inequality through redistribution. The giant's arguments seem reasonable, but Artegal reveals their flaw. Nature's apparent inequalities serve divine purposes beyond human understanding. Despite its sometimes harsh vision, Book V concludes by showing that even righteous causes face criticism. When Artegal returns, envy and detraction misrepresent his actions. Book 6 examines courtesy through Sir Calidore's pursuit of the Blatant Beast, a monster representing slander and gossip. Calidore embodies the ideal courtier, gracious, brave, and socially adept. His adventures show that true courtesy extends beyond manners to genuine concern for others. In a pivotal scene, Calidore discovers shepherds on Mount Acidale and witnesses the three graces dancing around a fourth maiden, representing poetry's ability to capture beauty. When his approach disrupts the vision, Spencer suggests that direct pursuit sometimes destroys what it seeks. Though Calidore eventually captures and muzzles the beast, Spencer notes it eventually breaks free, suggesting civil discourse requires constant vigilance. The unfinished seventh book, The Mutability Cantos, presents Spencer's most profound philosophical meditation. Here, mutability, a tightness representing change, challenges Jove's authority by claiming that all things are subject to her domain of alteration and decay. The confrontation unfolds on Arlo Hill, where mutability presents her case before nature's court. She offers an impressive case, demonstrating how seasons cycle endlessly, months succeed one another, and even celestial bodies show motion and transformation. She points to growth and decay in living things, the rise and fall of empires, and constant flux in human affairs. However, nature ultimately rules against her with a sophisticated resolution. While acknowledging change's reality, nature observes that while things change in appearance, their essential nature remains constant. This suggests that change itself operates within a framework of deeper permanence, where transformation serves to fulfill rather than destroy essential nature. This philosophical conclusion weaves together multiple traditions, reconciling classical philosophy with Christian theology. It suggests that change itself is part of a divine plan, operating within eternal law's bounds. The final stanza looks forward to when all shall rest eternally, suggesting earthly mutability ultimately yields to divine permanence. In a world that seems increasingly chaotic and unpredictable, isn't there comfort in believing that beneath all change lies something constant and enduring?